was, and one of the best-kept secrets in the Caribbean. Chiefy's first stop was the Rawlins Plantation, where he introduced me to Kevin, the owner, a short Welsh man with buck teeth and shifty eyes. From there, Chiefy and I moved on to Calypso Bay, Half Moon Bay, and half a dozen other places, each owned by a character more peculiar than the last. Most of them small-time operators, with big dreams of striking it rich in real estate on the developing island. It was the Wild West, but with an ocean view. The last place I looked at was St. Christopher Club, a small enclave of three-story white buildings on a narrow strip of land separating the Atlantic and Caribbean oceans. You know, of the last 25 units, 16 sold to Americans, and every one of them was in the citizenship program. The co-owner, Victor Doche, a short, garrulous man with a Charlie Brown smile, said as he walked me through a newly built apartment. Is that normal? No, it's new. Who bought them before? Originally, it was because of Idi Amin. I wasn't sure what this meant, though I later learned he was referring to Amin's expulsion of the entire Asian population of Uganda following a dream in which God told him to banish them. Then it was Russians. A lot were very powerful people. Not all of them were in the mafia, though. I bought my apartment back from a guy who was a general in the KGB. Now it's all Americans, he continued. One family is here because they fear war with Iran. Another because they don't want their children drafted. And another is here because they make money offshore and don't want to bring it back through the U.S. and have it taxed. Interesting. So I wasn't alone. I was part of a movement, an awakening, a disillusionment. The great American leaking pot. We were running away from war and death and taxes. If our instincts were right, we'd be rewarded with life. If they were wrong, we'd be stuck on one of the most beautiful islands I'd seen. There was no downside, or so I thought at the time. Victor was a similar seeker. He was born in Egypt, but, he explained, as a Christian, I saw that things were getting bad for my people in the 70s and left. He fled to Montreal, where he helped bring aerobics to the country with help from Jane Fonda. As he told his story, I was reminded of my silent pledge in Mrs. Kaufman's class, and I realized that running doesn't always mean hiding. Sometimes it means growing. The St. Kitts and Nevis passport is very good, he continued. Because the islands are part of the British Commonwealth, people use them as a backdoor entrance to Great Britain. I'm told that if you lose the passport in a foreign country and go to the British embassy, they'll replace it with a British passport. So not only was I going to become a Kittitian, I was going to become a member of the British Commonwealth. Maybe I could get my coveted EU passport after all. After looking at one of the apartments, a tranquil duplex with views of both coasts, I walked to the Atlantic beach a few yards away. The weather was warm but not hot, with a mild breeze. It felt as if this were the temperature at which the human body was designed to live. The waves crashed white and warm against the shore. There wasn't another person in sight. It was the antithesis of my life in cities up to that point. I recalled the five criteria Spencer and I had selected as requirements for a second citizenship: credible passport, stable government, minimal tax liability, maximum two-year wait for a citizenship, and warm climate with beaches. St. Kitts met every criterion. I crossed the property, walked 200 yards to the Caribbean coast, and ordered a rum punch at an open-air bar on the beach. The bar's co-owner, it turned out, also lived at St. Christopher Club. His name was Regan, and he told me that the Prime Minister of the island had a spare apartment in the complex. He also said there were plans to build a Ritz-Carlton next door, which would be good for property values. A new life seemed to await me here, free of petty concerns and complications. The slow, laid-back pace alone would probably prolong my life. And if I ever got caught in the system, all I had to do was knock on the Prime Minister's door with a bottle of wine and ask for advice. I couldn't imagine a better oasis for a technological nomad. Lesson 23. War, genocide, and other real estate scams. When I took a cab to the island's capital, Basse-Terre, at 5 a.m., the day after Christmas, the Juvet Street Party, the climax of the island's two-week-long Carnival celebration, was in full swing. Bands lined the sides of floats and trucks, hammering away on steel drums as hundreds of drunk revelers danced ecstatically behind them. It was not a show for tourists, but an age-old rite occurring despite my presence. It seemed hypocritical to call this place my home, when these were not my people, and this was not in my blood. I didn't belong here. Kevin didn't belong here. Victor didn't belong here. Regan didn't belong here. The Russians, Ugandans, and all the eccentric real estate developers with their big dreams didn't belong here. Then again, there was a time when these revelers didn't belong here either. The Kali Nago tribe fought the Igneri tribe for the island. The French and Spanish first fought the Kali Nago, then each other. The French and the British then fought, uniting briefly to massacre nearly the entire native population at a site now known as Bloody Point. Yet still the island belongs to no one. It's just a neutral witness to human nature. And all that blood, like most of the blood spilled over man's inability to cohabitate and share, has been shed for nothing. So until the battle resumes one day, the island's guests will spend their time exchanging pieces of paper that represent value for other pieces of paper that represent land, just as we do everywhere else in the world. More than warfare, this symbolic paper, a single sheet of which can make a man a slave or a king, is the pinnacle of human civilization. And that afternoon, I had my final meeting with a member of the race of man dedicated to the mastery of that paper, my lawyer. I can deal with bastards, but I hate assholes, Maxwell was telling someone on the phone when I entered. Some people, they shouldn't be dealt with nicely. When he hung up, I tried to make small talk and asked how his holiday had been so far. This was a mistake. I've been working the whole time. I can't take a vacation like you. He seemed to feel he was the only person in the world who had to work. It's because of this thing. He pointed to the mobile phone hanging from his belt. It never stops. I pulled the forms he'd given me out of an envelope I was carrying. I'd filled in my name, address, and my parents' address, but other questions, asking for my occupation, annual income, and reason for wanting the citizenship, I'd left blank, because I had no idea what the government was looking for. If it wanted to attract rich investors to the island, it would probably reject me because I was just a writer, and my income was nothing in comparison with the business magnates and Russian mobsters who usually applied for citizenship. So I asked Maxwell for advice. Is it better to put writer or author? Doesn't matter. How should I describe my source of income? They just need a guarantee you have one. Okay, one last question, then I'm out of your hair. What should I put down where it asks, reason seeking citizenship? He groaned as if he'd rather be in Guantanamo getting tortured, and uttered with great effort, alternative citizenship and future retirement home. As I filled out the rest of the application, he yelled something about making a mistake on my invoice at a beleaguered secretary who was wearing inordinately high red peep-toe shoes. She returned a few moments later with the largest bill I'd ever been handed in my life, $64,784.68, larger than the entire advance for this book. I didn't even have that kind of money lying around. I'll need you to wire that to my account, Maxwell informed me, along with the full cost of the apartment. I thought I was just supposed to pay a 10% deposit. Cold sweat began prickling my forehead and the back of my neck. The government likes to see all the money in an account, so they know that you won't back out. Until that moment, I hadn't given much thought to the practicalities of affording the citizenship. Perhaps if I took out a second mortgage on my current home, I might be able to raise that amount. Then I could take care of the monthly mortgage payments by renting out the unit when I wasn't on the island. So not only would I become a citizen of St. Kitts, I'd also become a foreign real estate speculator and shady landlord. But it was still a devastating amount of money. What if I was a victim in some sort of long con? Maxwell had a home team advantage. I was completely at the mercy of his word. He irritably shuffled through my documents, and handed me a piece of paper that would hopefully become my passport one day. "Write your name inside the box, but make sure it doesn't go outside the box," he told me, then repeated it as if I were stupid. "In order to submit your application," he continued, "I'll also need a negative HIV test, a clean police record, 9 passport photos, and a copy of your birth certificate." I handed him the lease agreement for St. Christopher Club and asked him if it was okay to sign. "I did all the documentation for St. Christopher Club," he replied, as if offended I dared to ask such a question. "So you wrote this agreement then?" A vertical tremor in his face seemed to imply his assent. This was quite possibly the stupidest thing I'd done in my life. "So," I asked, hoping for more reassurance than at my last visit, "what's the likelihood of this going through?" "As long as you have no criminal record, a clean HIV test, and no tax problems in the U.S., you're fine," he replied. "Anything else ever go wrong?" "As long as you have no criminal record, a clean HIV test, and no tax problems in the U.S., you're fine." It was clear he just wanted me out of his office. Foolishly, I tried to make more small talk in an effort to befriend him. "Hope you get some free time in." "I have another client coming," he responded. "Can I ask you to leave?" I walked out with a sinking feeling in my chest. In the Andrei Tarkovsky film Stalker, just before making a fateful decision, one character says to another, "There must be a principle. Never do anything that can't be undone." That principle is why, on the brink of a big decision, the first thing to fill my mind is doubt. What separates the strong from the weak, I reminded myself as I wandered sticker shock through the streets of Basse-Terre, is the ability to act instead of spending most of life paralyzed, too scared to make a choice that might be wrong. Lesson 24. Homework. Find a stranger you trust. St. Christopher Club, St. Kitts, 2007. I'm writing this on the dying battery of my computer. It's been months since I first visited this island, and though I have a place to live here now, I still don't have my citizenship. There was another blackout tonight. There are no backup generators, and the emergency lights only last 15 or so minutes. All the food in my refrigerator has spoiled again. And not only do I not have any matches for the candles, but I don't know where to get any. It's a holiday today, and everything nearby is closed. I don't have a car because the rental companies don't have any left. I know this because I called every single one of them yesterday. I hear footsteps in the hallway and voices outside. If someone came up here, it wouldn't be hard to break in. There's just a flimsy lock, like on the doorknob of a bathroom. You can open it with a butter knife. I don't know if I have any neighbors. I haven't seen a person in the complex the whole time I've been here, outside of the local workers, who always seem to be around. The apartment is on the flat part of the island, a little stretch of a square mile or two called Frigate Bay, home to most of the resorts and casinos and tourists. On the hill overlooking us is Basse-Terre, where the locals live in small townhouses and shanties. There are gangs there, and crime and murder. The snap can occur here too, just as it can in the United States, just as it has in the past in Haiti and China and the Ivory Coast. One little snap, be it due to hunger, unemployment, propaganda, or simple resentment, and they'd all come running down here with the machetes they once used to harvest sugarcane. It would be over in a matter of minutes. The police wouldn't help us. They too live up on the hill, and their loyalty is to the hill, not to the rich foreigners who treat them like servants. The American government wouldn't help us because it is far away and I am a traitor. There is only one solution if I am to stay here. I will have to stock up. Spencer was right. I've become so obsessed with repatriating that I haven't been looking at the big picture. A passport will help me escape, but it won't help me survive. I can't eat it, drink it, or defend myself with it. I can only run with it. To actually survive on my own, I'll need to stockpile emergency supplies. Plenty of them. Because if the power keeps going out on a regular day, I can't even imagine what would happen during an actual disaster. I'll need guns, too, to protect myself from marauders who want my emergency supplies and my television and my PlayStation. And more than anything, I'll need skills. I'll need to learn to live on my own without electricity, running water, gas. I'll need to learn to truly be sovereign. The lesson of Katrina wasn't that the United States can't protect its own. It was that no country can protect its own. No place is safe, and no government can guarantee the well-being of its citizens. There's only one place to find true safety: from within. Part 4. Survive. I must find the home of the faraway. He is a human being, just as I am. Yet he has found everlasting life. Surely he can teach me how to live for days without end. Gilgamesh, Tablet 9, 2100 BC. Lesson 25. Safety guidelines for the use of horses, guitars, and towels. I like the way you're thinking, Spencer said. I was telling him about my epiphany during the blackouts in St. Kitts. You have to make a thorough plan, though. What do you mean? Do you have guns yet? No. Can you fly a plane? No. Well, if the system breaks down, you won't only have to worry about surviving in St. Kitts. You also have to worry about how you're going to get there. I could hear the ring of satisfaction in his voice. He could tell my attitude had changed. There won't be major airline flights, or cell phone reception, or probably even working gas pumps. Good point. I'll try to get out ahead of time then. But what if there's no warning? The so-called system is something we take for granted. We depend on it to give us an inexhaustible supply of electricity, water, food, gas, internet, phone service, garbage removal, long-distance transportation, civil order, 24-hour convenience stores, and Seinfeld reruns. But what would happen if it stopped working, and suddenly there was nothing to depend on? My feeling, Spencer was saying, is that instead of evolving constantly toward a more advanced civilization, human history is cyclical. He had me in the palm of his hand now. His anxieties were my anxieties. And, just like Rome and Egypt and other advanced civilizations before us, we're past our zenith. We're growing weak, while the tribes that want to destroy modernity are growing stronger and more committed. To Flysians, civilizations don't keep evolving. They progress until some reactionary element hits the reset button, and they have to start all over again. Someday, he concluded, a future civilization is going to find our computers and hard drives and have no idea they contain the entire history of our society. They'll just think they're funny-looking rocks and use them as tools. After talking to Spencer, I walked to my bookshelf and pulled out the two Bruce Clayton books I'd ordered after dinner with my parents, Life After Doomsday and Life After Terrorism. As I leafed through them, I began to feel stupid for having thought that being independent of America meant just having a nationality and a bank account somewhere else. I needed to become independent of everything. All my life, I had thought that freedom was something that as Americans we were privileged to have, thanks to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. But those documents didn't create freedom. They created a system. And systems create dependencies. Real freedom, I realized, meant knowing not just where to go, but how to take care of myself if the system ever broke down. And since returning from St. Kitts, I didn't have just myself to look after anymore. I'd started dating someone. Her name was Katie. She was a quick-witted, high-spirited, Russian-American heartbreaker with two-toned black and blonde hair, and a penchant for midriff tops, tight blue jeans, and push-up bras. One night, I saw her sing Leonard Cohen's famous Blue Raincoat, while her sister Grace, accompanied her on guitar. From that day forward, I was smitten. In my survivalist fantasies, I'd imagined dating a rugged G.I. Jane type of girl who'd grown up on a farm and would teach me how to milk cows and feed chickens. Instead, I'd found someone with even less outdoor experience and more irrational fears than myself. Katie was scared not just of driving a car and flying in a plane, but of literally everything. From guitars, she was afraid a string would break and lash her in the face, to hotel towels, she'd seen a documentary on microscopic bugs that live in linens, to horses, she was afraid they'd think her nose was a carrot and bite it off. Oh, and also ponds. They're like toilets for birds that never get flushed, she'd say. Unlike me, Katie had been popular in high school, and consequently, learning to be self-sufficient had never crossed her mind. If she was too scared to do something, there were always 50 guys around who would gladly do it for her. So she had trouble understanding the growing pile of survivalist books on my table. "My boyfriend's going a bit nutty," she wrote in her journal after we started dating. "Something must really be going wrong if he's stocking up on all those books. I hope my hair straightener still works if it does." At one point in history, almost everyone was a survivalist. They knew how to hunt, farm, fight, and keep themselves and their families alive without the infrastructure and conveniences we have now. The modern survivalist movement began as a nostalgic yearning for that way of life. Its grandfather was Harry Brown, one of the libertarian authors Greg had recommended at the Sovereign Society Conference. Concerned about inflation, the devaluation of the dollar, and nuclear war with Russia, Brown began leading seminars in the late 60s on how to survive an economic collapse in America. He was soon joined by Don Stevens, an architect who gave the movement's followers the name Retreaters. Worried that cities would erupt into violence in the face of a food, water, power, or other shortage, Retreaters advocated building self-sufficient homes and communities in rural areas to flee to. Then, in the 70s, a man named Kurt Saxon came along. Saxon, an ultra-right-winger who'd grown up during the Great Depression, didn't have much use for people like Brown. At various points, he was a member of the Neo-Nazi Party, the John Birch Society, and the Minutemen. In 1970, he appeared before a Senate investigation subcommittee after suggesting liberals be bombed. Considering the word retreater wimpy, he began popularizing the term survivalist in his newsletter, The Survivor. Around the same time, the other fathers of the movement emerged from the right wing. Among them were Howard Ruff, a financial advisor who wrote Famine and Survival in America in the wake of the 1973 oil crisis, and Mel Tappan, who published his most famous book, Survival Guns, and started a newsletter, Personal Survival Letter, in 1977, the year blackouts in New York led to widespread looting and arson. "If a social breakdown comes," Tappan wrote in one of many essays on his favorite subject, "you may be faced with living under primitive conditions for a year, a decade, or even the rest of your life. And your basic life support problems will almost certainly be complicated by encounters with desperate, dangerous mobs of people who have made no crisis preparations of their own and who are anxious to avail themselves of yours by force. Instead of compromise or improvisation, such circumstances call for the most specialized and efficient arms available." It was these men who both gave birth to survivalism and gave the term its fearsome reputation. And so I did what any aspiring survivalist would do. I called them and asked where to begin. Lesson 26. Life advice from the world's friendliest Nazi. I had very little time to learn as much as I could about survivalism while waiting for the results of my St. Kitts citizenship application. So I decided to start with the man who supposedly coined the word, Kurt Saxon, who was now 76 years old. Though he hadn't returned my inquiries when I was a journalist reporting on Y2K, I hoped he'd be more receptive to me as a fellow survivalist. After tracking down his number, I called and was surprised to hear him pick up on the first ring. Somewhat nervously, I told him I was interested in learning the skills necessary for survival and self-sufficiency. I was sure that after 3 decades of being the figurehead of the movement, he'd be sick of such requests. Since he'd been a member of so many hate groups, I also assumed he'd be somewhat aggressive, cantankerous, and paranoid. His response, however, was not one I ever would have predicted. "Do you feel threatened?" he asked in what may have been the friendliest voice this side of Mr. Rogers. "I do," I replied. "You shouldn't." His tone was warm and accommodating, like he was telling a child not to be afraid of the sound of thunder. "Why is that?" "Because paranoia doesn't pay." "I'm surprised to hear you say that," I responded. "So you're optimistic about the future of America?" "Everything is going to hell," he replied, matter-of-factly. "I'm a historian. I know what's happening now. I can predict that within 5 years, 4/5 of humanity will have starved to death." "If that's true, then why are you saying I shouldn't feel threatened?" "Well, I don't feel threatened." "Why is that?" "Because I live in Arkansas." This had to be one of the most circular conversations I'd ever had. He was like the Cheshire Cat of survivalism. "I guess that's safer than a metropolis like Los Angeles or New York," I replied, struggling to keep pace. "Well, you want to move. I think you'd like it here. For instance, I haven't seen a black person in over a year." I was aghast to hear these words come out of his mouth, despite his background. Perhaps he sensed it in my silence, because he backpedaled somewhat. "This is northern Arkansas. There are blacks in southern Arkansas, but they're nice." I didn't really know how to respond. I wasn't going to agree, but after years of interviewing musicians, I'd learned that if someone feels you're judging them, they'll never open up to you. So instead of being critical or insisting your views are more correct, you give them what every human being really wants, deep down: acceptance, approval, and understanding. "I'll consider changing my location," I replied, haplessly adding in a struggle to change the topic, "I bet the food is great down there." "You can't understand how stupid people can be till you move to Arkansas. Anyone who can read without moving his lips here is considered an intellectual. I'm more of an objectivist. Have you read Ayn Rand? Atlas Shrugged is one of my best books. I'm kind of a Howard Roark." I'd started the book 3 times but never finished it. Yet everyone I talked to, whether PTs or survivalists, seemed to swear by it. It was time to pick it up again. And when I did, I would learn that Roark was the protagonist, not of Atlas Shrugged, but of Rand's earlier book, The Fountainhead. "I'm neither left-wing nor right-wing," Saxon continued. 40 years ago, I had a habit of joining nut groups. And you can't find any nuttier group than the Nazis. They were fun. When we disbanded, we formed the Iron Cross Motorcycle Club, and we were the toughest stormtroopers out there. We were terrorists. We used terror. If there is, as paranoid people suspect, an FBI phone monitoring system that begins recording every time certain words are used in a conversation, Saxon had definitely tripped it by now. Occasionally the police would call and tell us there was going to be a hippie bash protesting the war, and we'd go in, Saxon continued. The police loved to watch because they hated hippies. Still, some of our guys wanted to quit and join the left because they had better booze, dope, and girls. In the same patient, grandfatherly voice, Saxon talked to me for another hour, then promised to send a package with back copies of The Survivalist, an 18th century compendium of recipes for food and medicine called The Complete Housewife, and all 4 volumes of his do-it-yourself, bomb-making, booby-trap-setting, chemical weapon manufacturing, street-fighting manual, The Poor Man's James Bond. "My main thing is to save the best of our species," he explained, "and to collect and preserve useful knowledge." I felt conflicted talking to him. Anyone who joins the Nazi Party for any reason is thoroughly despicable, yet Saxon seems so guileless and giving. Then again, if you ask Charles Lindbergh what he thought after meeting Hermann Goering in the 1930s, he would have told you the Nazi commander was a swell guy. Are we best friends? Saxon asked before I hung up. I guess so. I didn't know how to reply. Usually it takes a few ball games and nights on the town to become best friends, but not for Saxon. Oh yes, he concluded, we are. And true to his word, he called me at least once a week after that conversation. Lesson 27. Introducing the Urban Survival Kit. Though it was nice to have the father of survivalism as a friend, it wasn't getting me any closer to learning how to save myself in an emergency. Even his books, when they arrived, were just compendiums of information, invaluable for reference, but useless for beginners like myself. Most survivalists had an advantage over me. Maybe they were born on a farm and knew about crops and livestock. Perhaps their fathers had taken them camping or hunting or fishing. Maybe they'd even had experience at an early age with woodworking, engine repair, or electrical wiring. But I was raised in urban apartments. Up on the 42nd floor of our 72-story building, we not only had no backyard and no pets, but no fresh air. We were so high up that our windows wouldn't open more than a crack. Repairing things meant calling building maintenance, and dining at home meant that Dad picked up takeout food on the way back from work. The only useful survival skill I had, thanks to researching a form of persuasion known as neuro-linguistic programming for the game, was the ability to try to talk to people with practical knowledge into helping me out. And now I also had a stack of books from Saxon, filled with cool plans and diagrams, but no skills or tools to actually use them. I asked Katie one morning whether she'd learned any survival skills while growing up. I don't know how to make food, she began. I can't sew. I can't drive. I can probably talk someone out of killing me. That's the only thing I can do, baby. Between the two of us, then, conversation was our only survival skill. Perhaps we were a perfect match. I grabbed a piece of paper and wrote survival to-do list across the top. Then, since Saxon hadn't been much help getting started, I tracked down Bruce Clayton, or Shihan Clayton, as his website said he was now known since achieving his 6th-degree black belt in Shotokan karate. Oddly, like Saxon, Shihan Clayton started the phone call by telling me there was nothing to be afraid of. Perhaps it was a reflex from years of being pilloried in the media. I'm not particularly frightened by the terrorist thing, said the author of Life After Terrorism. They're an out-of-control street gang with grandiose ideas. There are bigger and tougher organizations cruising the streets of Los Angeles. When he realized I wasn't calling to challenge him, but to learn from him, Clayton began to open up. There are a number of directions problems can come from, he said, finally. One is, what nasty surprises can Al-Qaeda come up with in the United States? The second direction is that Iran will get nuclear bombs, though they'll be sorely divided on whether to drop the first one on Tel Aviv or Paris. The third danger is that China and Korea are getting better at building bombs. They can reach the West Coast now, and soon they'll be able to reach all of the United States. So we're looking at another Cold War there. And with rising gasoline prices and ethanol affecting the price of corn, we may be looking at an economically difficult time in the United States. The fears of Americans change over time. In late 1999, we feared the collapse of our computer system. Then it was terrorist attacks. Then it was our own government. Then it was global warming. Today, it's economic collapse. Fear, it seems, is like fashion. It changes every season. And even though threats like terrorism persist to this day, we eventually grow bored of worrying about them and turn to something new. Ultimately, though, every fear has the same root: anxiety about things we take for granted going away. The truth is, Clayton continued, In terms of riots or terrorist incidents, the threat zone is going to be pretty limited. You can walk out of a threat zone, typically. So all you need for the basics are nice shoes and an urban survival kit. What's an urban survival kit? 3 things. A cell phone, an ATM card, and a pistol. I have 2 out of 3, but I've never fired a pistol in my life. I'd only had firearms in my house once, when I wrote a book with Dave Navarro, documenting the rock guitarist's addiction to heroin and cocaine. I'd removed a handgun and a shotgun from his house because I was worried he'd kill himself. But I had trouble sleeping at night, knowing such dangerous weapons were sitting in my closet. Any thief who broke in would know how to use them better than I did. So rather than return them to Navarro and be responsible if anything happened to him, I gave them away to a friend named, appropriately, Justin Gunn. The first requirement in using a gun correctly is not shooting yourself with it, Clayton was telling me. It's a martial art, and you have to take it seriously. It's not like learning to change a tire. I went out to the Gunsight Ranch in Arizona. In a week, they can teach you how to be damn dangerous with a gun. He paused and reconsidered. Actually, the guy who buys the gun and puts it in his pocket, he's dangerous. Gunsight graduates aren't dangerous. They're deadly. And so I added the first item to my survival to-do list. Learn to shoot. I heard the voice of Spencer Booth gloating in my head as I wrote those 3 words down. I had crossed over to the other side. Lesson 28. Just say no to cheerleading. I need to make 2 stops, I told the cab driver. First, I have to go to Gun World on Magnolia. Then I'm going to the Burbank Airport. As soon as the words left my mouth, I realized I sounded like a madman. I tried to think of some way to explain the sequence of stops rationally. That I wasn't planning to spray gunfire in the airport, but actually picking up a pistol so I could fly to a place called Gunsight in Arizona and learn to shoot. But that sounded just as dubious. Though I didn't think I'd be allowed to fly with a gun, when I called Southwest Airlines earlier that week, I was surprised to discover that it was fine, as long as I declared it and kept it unloaded in a locked case in my checked luggage. The taxi driver, a bald, frowning Armenian in a sweat-stained white polo shirt, took me wordlessly to Gun World, checking me out in the rearview mirror every few minutes, just in case he drove away, worried that I'd kill him or hold him hostage when I returned with my gun. I brought my suitcase into the store. Earlier that day, while packing for Gunsight, I dug through my closet to find practical clothing for shooting in the hot desert sun all day and under the cold desert sky at night. I came up nearly empty-handed. For most of my life, I'd bought clothes with the intention of being fashionable and hopefully attracting women. My jeans weren't rugged and durable, but slim-legged and waxy, and I wore accoutrements like wrist cuffs and wallet chains, which had no practical use to me. I didn't even carry a wallet. I had the clothing of an urban cafe dweller, not a survivalist. Katie tried to stop me as I left for Gunsight that morning. I just don't picture you holding a gun, babe. She knew me well. What if you get shot there, or your gun blows up in your face? Those were the same questions I'd been asking myself. I'll be okay, I said, as much to convince myself as her. Why are you always so scared of everything, anyway? I'd always wanted to ask her that. I think I watched too many movies as a kid, and I have a good memory, so I remembered all the scary things I saw. It's a big world out there, and I'm a little person, you know? Though Katie was reluctant to admit it, movies weren't the only source of her insecurities. Her stepfather used to punish her by making her kneel for an hour holding a box over her head, and beat her if she dropped it. Once, on her birthday, he yelled at her for opening her presents carelessly, sent her to her room, and confiscated her gifts. And he constantly told Katie she grew up to be ugly, which is probably what led to her inability to leave the house without fixing herself up for an hour in the bathroom. When you grow up like that, You spend the rest of your life trying to avoid things that are dangerous, Katie continued, like dark alleys and cheerleading. Why cheerleading? I don't want to end up on the top of the pyramid and fall off and break my bones, she explained as I listened incredulously. I don't want to be on the bottom because my back could break, and I don't want to be in the middle because someone could fall on me. She paused and thought about it a little more. There's really no safe place in that pyramid, babe. But what about bigger threats like terrorism and the economy? I try not to think about those things. My fears, I realized, were different from Katie's. Mine were forcing me out of my comfort zone. Hers were making her retreat. And though it may be tempting to write off her fears as irrational, I later learned that roughly 66% of all severe sports-related injuries to female high school and college students are due to cheerleading accidents. And the main cause of those injuries is actually pyramids. Nonetheless, I needed to find a way to make Katie face her anxieties, because they were holding her back from life and making her too dependent on others to take care of her. Before I could help her conquer her fears, though, I needed to do something about my own. After picking up my gun, I resumed my taxi ride to the airport with the nervous Armenian driver. 15 minutes later, with my heart in my throat, prepared at any moment for security to wrestle me to the ground, I walked to the airline counter and repeated the exact words the clerk at Gun World had told me to say. I'll be checking in a firearm. It's in my duffel, and it's in a locked case and unloaded. I'll need to see it, said the ticket agent, a pasty blonde woman dotted with moles. She eyed me suspiciously. Maybe I was too nervous. I repositioned my body in an attempt to block the view of the passengers in line behind me, and removed the case from my duffel. Then I placed it on the scale, unlocked it, and pulled out the gun. Nobody panicked, nobody screamed, nobody tackled me. At that moment, if I'd wanted, I could have sprayed bullets all over the airport. But that would have made me an idiot, and the point of the gun was to protect myself from idiots like myself. After telling me to remove the magazine, the mole lady asked me to put the gun back in the case and then taped a label to it. As a precaution, she added, after giving me a boarding pass, you may want to wait near that door for 10 minutes in case TSA has any questions. When no one appeared after 15 minutes, I headed through security and to the gate, on my way to Arizona to learn how to kill. Although a gun can't do much harm in a locked box in a plane's cargo hold, I had no idea it was this easy to fly with a firearm. It was the first time, since I began this journey, that I discovered a freedom I didn't know I had, rather than a new restriction. Lesson 29. A Philosophy of the Sphincter. Make no mistake about what we do here, snarled Ed Head, the operations manager of Gunsight. This is a fighting school. Sitting in front of him were 40 gun-wielding students, soldiers, sheriffs, corrections officers, and me. This will be a life-changing experience, he continued. Most of you are going to leave on Friday a different person. You're going to be better trained than 95% of all law enforcement officers in the United States. He waited to let the fact sink in. And you'll develop a different kind of confidence that comes from the ability to take care of yourself. His last words, the ability to take care of yourself, were just what I needed to hear, especially after signing 6 pages of waivers, promising not to sue them if I was accidentally shot in the head. For the next 2 hours, the range masters, Charlie McNeese and Ken Campbell, indoctrinated us into the mental spirit of battle. You don't rise to the occasion, McNeese lectured. You default to your level of training. When the stress hits, you will only be half as good as your best day of recent training. McNeese appeared to be in his late 50s, with his gray beard, genial southern accent, and toothy smile. He looked like a dangerous Colonel Sanders. Excitement won't kill you, he concluded, but surprise will. This was the kind of knowledge I needed. It seemed more useful and exciting than knowing the inflation rate and the price of gold and most of what they taught at the Sovereign Society. Perhaps because McNeese's words were meant for fighters, not runners, and I still knew nothing about fighting. After the lecture, we picked up 1,000 rounds of ammunition and drove down a dirt road to an outdoor gun range. A sign posted in a shed there read in big black letters, "I'd rather be whacking tangos." I asked another student, a squat police officer who seemed physically unable to change the shape of his mouth into anything other than a straight line, what a tango was. "A terrorist," he replied, as if it were obvious, which perhaps it was. He didn't speak another word to me for the rest of the week. I soon earned the derision of the rest of the class by asking the instructor to help me put on my gun belt. It was clear I would be the slowest student there. I may have had book smarts, but I was sorely lacking in motor skills, practical knowledge, and common sense. In a survival situation, every other person here would most likely outlast me. Perhaps the reason I was so worried about the draft when I was a teenager was that I knew I'd die. If I was on patrol and someone yelled duck, my head would be the last to go down and the first to get shot. The only other person struggling with the class was a tank of a woman named Stephanie, a Navy officer who was being deployed to Iraq the following month. Her problem was the Beretta 9mm pistol she was using. Not only did it seem to underperform against every other weapon in class, but it was constantly jamming and misfiring. When I asked why she was using the Beretta, she explained that it's the gun the government issues to most of the U.S. military. In fact, she complained, the government had just bought 25,000 more Beretta M9s. Every time her pistol jammed in class after that, I imagined it happening in an actual gunfight in Iraq. Other than Stephanie, I was the only other student with a 9mm gun. Everyone else had larger, more powerful 45s, mostly 1911 Colts, which were favored by the late Colonel Jeff Cooper, the severe, charismatic shooting star who founded Gunsight in 1976. "Why do we carry 45s? McNeese replied when I asked about the gun. "Because they don't make 46s. At Gunsight, we didn't just learn how to draw a pistol, shoot rapid fire, quickly clear gun malfunctions, speed reload, and hit targets at night. We learned the science of killing. Here, there were no such things as bullet holes. They were called leak points. As McNeese taught us, the bigger the bullet, the more fluid goes out, and the more air comes in. As Campbell taught us, when a guy hits the ground, the fight isn't over. He's dropping because the hole in him is causing his blood pressure to drop. But when he's down, his blood pressure will rise again, and this means he could still be a threat. As an instructor named Mike taught us, if you shoot him in the skull is a hard thing. The bullet could just deflect and he'll still be standing. You actually want to get him in the eye. While Mike lectured, I looked around and realized that many of the people there had either killed before or were preparing to kill, and without remorse. In their world, there seemed to be two kinds of people, good guys and bad guys. Good guys should have guns, bad guys shouldn't, and they were the good guys. It wasn't too difficult to figure this out. One student, a former Green Beret named Evan, was wearing a shirt that read, "I'm the good guy." Personally, I don't believe in good guys and bad guys, as compelling as those stories may be to children. There are no bad guys. Just people who do bad things. Most of them aren't trying to be bad. They either think they're the good guys, got stuck in a bad situation and lost control, or have something wrong with their heads that's a product of the way they were raised, the drugs they're using, or the chemistry in their brains. Most of them think they're a hero to someone, and sadly, they're right, just as every good guy is a villain to someone. In a Flysian world, there is no black and white, only gray. Midway through the week, we were taken to a shoot house. It was a building with multiple rooms filled with human replicas. Some were armed criminals, others innocent civilians, The instructors taught us how to open doors, look around corners, and move through a house where armed intruders are present. Then they sent us into the building one by one to take out the bad guys. Though it was a simulation, my adrenaline kicked in instantly. I pushed the front door open, then quickly backed away with my gun in the ready position. I saw a man in the corridor in a leather jacket, holding something shiny and menacing in his right hand. I gave him what they called the gun sight salute, 2 bullets aimed at the heart, 1 at the head. When I entered the corridor, though, I discovered that what was in his hands wasn't actually a gun, it was a beer bottle. For the rest of the exercise, I was shaken. All I could think was, if this had been real life, I would have just killed an innocent person. I suppose that was one of my problems with guns. You know what your problem is? McNeese asked afterward. Target identification? Nope. He touched the tip of his index finger to the middle joint of his thumb to make a small circle. I stared at it a second, wondering what it was supposed to symbolize. Your sphincter, he informed me. My what? Your sphincter. Every time you shoot, it gets like this. He narrowed the circle formed by his thumb and index finger. It gets tight and itty-bitty. And when your sphincter gets tight, do you know what happens? I can't shoot. You can't even think. When your sphincter gets that tight, it cuts off the blood to your brain, and that cuts off the circulation to your muscles. So your shooting is all over the place. He gave me a friendly smack on the shoulder, hard enough to throw me off balance, as if to prove a point. If you have a more relaxed muscle, body, and mind, you're going to perform at a higher level than when you're extremely uptight. So you've got to learn to relax, son. The sphincter will mess you up. I watched as the next student entered the shoot house. Since he was a police officer, I figured he'd do better than me, but he shot the innocent man as well. You just got yourself a lawsuit, McNeese told him. Not if I fix it in the report, the officer joked. By the last day of class, I'd taken McNeese's advice to heart. I slowed down, relaxed, and loosened the sphincter muscle. Instead of trying to remember all the details essential to accurate shooting, I simply trusted myself to do it. Coolly, slowly, and methodically. Soon I was pressing the trigger instead of pulling it jerkily, keeping my eye on the front sight of the gun, hitting targets in clusters around the heart and eyes, and making it through entire shoot houses without killing a single innocent. In 1.5 seconds, day and night, I could draw a holstered pistol, aim at a target 7 yards away, and shoot it twice in the heart. It wasn't just a lesson in marksmanship, it was a lesson in life. We're in America, we're shooting guns, it's a good day, Campbell proclaimed as he walked down the range, watching his students blast the hearts out of their targets. There's nothing better in the world. In my final shoot house session, I noticed that the first gunman was wearing a bulletproof vest, so I shot him in the head. In the kitchen, I spotted another gunman outside the window and shot him in the heart. And in the last room, there was a target with a gun, but beneath it, he was holding a small child. I asked him to release the child, and when he didn't, I shot him in the head, twice. I'm impressed, McNeese said. So you are trainable. A feeling of relief washed over my body. I had succeeded in my mission. I felt like I could protect my home in St. Kitts and in Los Angeles, at least from small bands of looters who hadn't been trained at gunsight. In the process, though, something strange had occurred. I developed a bloodlust I'd never felt before. I actually wanted an excuse to shoot a bad guy, so I could experience what the instructors had talked about. Guns are designed to kill, and to understand them correctly is to understand killing. Not shooting anyone was like learning to golf on a driving range, but never going to an actual course. Of course, ask anyone about golf at gunsight, and they'll tell you it's a waste of a perfectly good rifle range. I began to understand how armies could so easily indoctrinate new recruits to murder. It's as easy as stereotyping a group of people as bad, then teaching soldiers day after day how to kill them before they kill you. The better the training, the more of a waste it would be not to use it. After all, those who don't know how to fight tend to stay out of fights. Be safe, McNeese told us during our graduation ceremony, and be good to everyone you meet, but always have a plan to kill them. He then handed us our diplomas. I'll tell you something, Stephanie, the student with the government Beretta, told me after the ceremony. The day I checked in here, I had fired a handgun probably twice before. This course has probably saved my life. Afterward, we went to Colonel Cooper's house to meet his widow and look through his memorabilia. I sat and talked with McNeese, who recommended some of the other courses. Don't go into a gunfight with a pistol, he confided, leaning in close. It's a low